On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks about the dialogue between science and faith with Peter Bannister from the American Church in Paris.
Modern Christianity is completely wed to materialism in some fundamental ways that make it hard to pull it out of there. So this is the rub I have with some of my Christian friends, and it gets down to doctrine. And I keep pushing, saying, well, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't make sense. You can't really have this doctrine. You can't really have this belief set as rigidly as it is it's practiced. And then the fallback is, well, come on, I am a Christian. And I think that there's a direct parallel with the scientist. I think the scientist, at the end of the day, what they're really saying is, you know, I am a materialist because if I can't measure it, I'm out of business. I don't really know what I do if you tell me I can't really measure everything, that this reality isn't the limit of what I can go out and run my experiments on.
What's curious, if you actually do the history, is that that's a relatively recent phenomenon. And it is tied, I think that there is a very close tie to the rise of a certain type of science, a religious rationalism, which insists that the doctrine really is about questions of proof and questions of discursive knowledge, propositions, a dogma in the worst sense. The truth that we're about is much more relational than it is propositional. And I think that there actually are a lot of people in Christianity, but perhaps not only in Christianity, perhaps in other sort of wisdom traditions and faiths, who are saying that, hang on, one of the big problems in the world today is that we've got hooked up with this notion of dogma in the sense of an effort to control, and that that is common both to a certain type of science and a certain type of religion. And we can see what problems that has created from both those streams.
That's the bridge that we have to cross, is that science is a religion, atheism is a religion, and now we're all on the same playing field.
Because it's our ultimate concern. That's, I think, a very good definition of religion, is whatever is your ultimate concern is de facto your religion. And I think if you go back to the idea of who do we want around this table, obviously the entry fee, as you say, is a certain ability to let go, or to say, okay, we all bring ourselves to this, but we bring ourselves to this in an open way. My hope is that there is a groundswell of people who have this openness and who are genuinely interested in examining the data in an open and intelligent way.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, we're going to look at the ongoing debate between science and religion, and in particular, between science and Christianity. We're going to do so with a very interesting guest, Peter Bannister, from the American University in Paris. I think it's all quite self-explanatory. Let's get right to the interview. Today, we welcome Peter Bannister to Skeptico. Peter holds graduate degrees in music from King's College, Cambridge, and philosophical theology from the University of Wales. He's an award-winning composer and performer and is co-directing a very interesting lecture series at the American Church in Paris, promoting an increased and enhanced dialogue in the relationship between science and faith. Welcome, Peter. Thanks so much for joining me on Skeptico.
I'm delighted to be with you, Alex.
Well, I'm very excited to have you on as well. You have such a diverse background, and I love the way you've initiated this dialogue, particularly from your position. So you'll have to tell us a little bit, firstly, about the American Church in Paris, which sounds like quite an interesting institution with a rich, rich history, and then also about this lecture series you've become a part of.
It has indeed had a rich, rich history, I think, the American Church in Paris, which includes famous incidents such as Bob Dylan singing in the basement in the 1960s, along with Joan Baez, and the Gestapo coming and looking for the church organist who was kind of running the church in World War II under the occupation in Paris, Martin Luther King Jr. preaching from the pulpits more or less straight after he'd, or maybe on the way to receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. It's a unique, or perhaps not unique, but it's certainly an unusual congregation in the sense that it's extremely international. The title American Church is pretty nominal, really. We've got people from basically every continent except Antarctica, and a symphony of languages, and people from really all over the map in terms of also their faith background, if they have one. You're never quite sure who you're going to meet. It's sometimes a wild ride, and I personally find that very stimulating, always challenging.
Yes, yes, and a perfect place to ferment a discussion about the relationship between science and faith, no doubt, right?
Exactly, and also Paris has a very, very long history of that. I'd say that in France, the tradition of looking at religion in really kind of evolutionary terms can be traced right back to the second century, even, with the Bishop Irenaeus of Lyon, who was a Greek based in France, and one of the key thinkers of the early church, was actually very creative in his approach to the whole question of, you know, what is the nature of the relationship of the human and the divine, and is seen by many figures in the science faith dialogue today as actually a potentially really rich kind of resource. And then, I suppose, closer to where we are historically, the great French paleontologist and Jesuit Théard de Chardin, who is, I think, a thinker that many people listening to this program may well be familiar with, whether or not they're Christian, extraordinary creative thinker, and one who's sort of in the background to a lot of discussion in France, whether people admit it or not.
So, Peter, tell us a little bit about the series, the lecture series, what you set out to do, and to what extent you were able to bridge this gap, or at least try and create this dialogue we're talking about. Because I think there's some challenges to it at a deep level, and you know, we can kind of paper over the differences sometimes too, and that's one of the things I really want to push on a little bit. Are we dialoguing for the sake of dialogue so we can all feel good that haven't we had this conversation, or are we really making progress towards a deeper understanding, a deeper connection between these two discourses in our society that seem to always be at odds?
Well, I think that's a great set of questions that would probably take us the rest of the interview to answer. But if I can just sort of give a little bit of history on how this came about. Back in 2009, it was the 150th anniversary of the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species. And some, how can I put this? Some church members came to the senior pastor, Scott Herr, and myself, about the whole question of evolution, particularly in terms of school curricula. I think that they were feeling kind of lost in the maze of how to react, particularly as they were Americans and had been through some of the controversies over that, such as the Dover trial was only 4 years ago. And they were very interested, obviously, in issues such as intelligent design, and really put not exactly pressure on us, but really felt that it was urgent that we discussed the issues. Now, as you say, I think it's important not to paper over the cracks. And the first series of lectures that we set up, involving a number of sort of guest speakers, including my father, actually, who's a research scientist, and philosopher Keith Ward from Oxford, who again some of you may or may not be familiar with.
Well, let me interject there. Let's stop for a minute and talk a little bit about your background, because in reading your bio, I found that interesting. That, you know, with this theological background you have, it was peppered by this ongoing dialogue you've had with your father, who is a well-recognized scientific academic. And so maybe you want to talk a little bit about that. And then Keith Ward, as you're just mentioning, I think is probably known to people as being one of the primary debaters whenever Richard Dawkins steps up.
There's
a lot of times it's Keith Ward stepping off and going, hey, wait a minute, you know, there's another side to look at this. So,
yeah, they've got a kind of special relationship. Just to set the record straight, I'm not a trained scientist myself, but like you say, my father is. And I suppose that's a hidden side of me, to the extent that my first love was really music. And yet I think that music, historically, if you look at it, has been a science as much as it's been an art. Certainly it was until the end of the Renaissance, really. And so there is an interest there, obviously, in the link with mathematics, the link with questions of the harmonies of the spheres and all that kind of stuff that the ancients, from Pythagoras onwards, were interested in. And one of my great heroes as a composer was the French Catholic composer Olivier Messiaen, who was an amazing pedagogue. I didn't study with him, but I know an almost unhealthy amount about him through my kind of musicological research. And in his classes, he would handle subjects such as Einstein's theory of relativity, contemporary cosmology, mathematical permutations, and all sorts of stuff. And in a way, that's a kind of revitalization of a very old tradition of seeing music in terms of a broad interdisciplinary discussion, which involves, on one hand, the big questions, those are existential questions, which are to do with our personal emotions and feelings. But it also has to do with the structure of the cosmos. And so I think that's really how I managed to get back into the scientific area of thought that I'd sort of run away from as a kid, because I wasn't that good at it, really.
You know, to punctuate that point, I was struck by your email you sent me, and you referenced Rupert Sheldrake, who I didn't know is also a musician. Not
That's
to
right.
your caliber, but also is at least skilled enough to experience the transcendency sometimes of performing. And
yeah,
you
absolutely.
went further to say that in your experience, you don't think that the musical experience is fully explainable from a materialistic, reductionistic kind of explanation. From an experiential level, you're saying, hey, that just doesn't fit. There's something more.
Exactly. And it's interesting you mentioned Rupert Sheldrake. And it wasn't until recently that I discovered that during the time he spent in India, he was actually the church organist at the cathedral in Hyderabad. And this came out in an interview with the British press quite recently. And he said that he didn't feel, and this is something that really resonated strongly with me, that Bach was really just explicable by electrical activity in the brain. And I think that is sort of at the hub of a lot of this argument. And you find that thought also in thinkers such as Keith Ward, that in all the things that we as human beings find really meaningful in our lives, such as relationships, feelings, senses of value, meaning, you're talking about something which is just not reducible to neuron activity. And that's, in some respects, a countercultural thing to say. But if you really press me on it, I'd say, well, in my experience, I really feel that. And most musicians, I think, if you ask them deep down, you know, what is really driving your passion for music, I think that many, many would say that, in some respects, it is a sense of something beyond themselves. And when you talk to research scientists, often they have the same sense of awe, in fact. And this came out very much in our lecture series when, for example, we had a woman who had been participating in the Human Genome Project. And the way that people talk about the mystery of life is very similar to the way that artists will talk about the mystery of, you know, inspiration, for lack of a better word.
Well, there's also the parallel that's been drawn out by many biographers of great musicians, certainly Mozart and Bach, as you mentioned, but they explicitly have said, I am not the composer. I am literally being downloaded this information. And they often say it in not in theological or religious terms, but in terms of experientially, you know, this is what's happening. And I just remember it in the biography of Mozart, you know, his work is recorded without any edits or prior, you know, drafts.
Yeah, sure.
It just comes out flowing on the page, which, you know, I don't know your era, but modern composers say that's just impossible. It can't be fathomed. And the parallel I think is interesting to draw is in the transcendent spiritual experience. So if we want to talk about near-death experience for a minute, again and again, or let me interject, you could also say sometimes in psychedelic experiences, there's this downloading of information, you know. So I had a near-death experience. I went to God, and God explained everything to me. I had questions, and they were instantly downloaded into my brain. And I can only bring back a fraction of it, but experientially, that's what happens. So again, an interesting parallel, you know, not just with science, but with the transcendent spiritual experience.
Sure. I mean, I think it poses big questions about the nature of knowledge. You know, what do we mean in terms of reason? And I think that this is where a musician's perspective is, I think, of course I'm biased, but I think it is quite helpful sometimes to know that the sort of analytical way of looking at the world is, of course, very useful in terms of as a tool for sort of dissecting experience. But it's not the only way of relating to reality. And I'm very struck reading the near-death experience reports to see how often music comes up. You find this, I listened to your podcast with Eben Alexander, for example, in which it reads for me like the program note to a work of Olivier Messiaen. It's really quite extraordinary, the idea that he came across in his account these kind of arcs of light, which were also kind of hymns, which is extraordinary. But a lot of my musicological work had focused also on Messiaen's theory of synesthesia, the sort of fusion of the senses, in which
his actual experience of synesthesia, right?
I mean, that's quite controversial, because sometimes Messiaen said that that it was really an sort of intellectual phenomenon, that he did in a way copied it from a painter friend of his. But certainly he could describe in such vivid terms that I was just today talking with one of the big Messiaen scholars, a brilliant Jesuit historian who's now working at Loyola University in Chicago, who's writing a fantastic monograph actually on Messiaen, and saying, you know, did Messiaen as a young man have a near-death experience? Because it's so similar, the reports of NDEers, and the way that he talks about the correspondence between sound and color. What's all that about? That just really fascinates me. And I think that in terms of a rather more fluid state of consciousness, that clearly is integral to the way that a composer such as Messiaen would have experienced the musical phenomenon. Also because he was an improviser. This is the other thing, because that's one of the aspects of music that's really always fascinated me. The idea that that you can create a spontaneous music, which you control to a certain extent, but feels ultimately, especially once you start playing fast and once your brain can't control in such a rational way, it feels as if something is flowing through you, more that you steer, but that you didn't initiate, in a way. And I think that ties in very closely with what you're saying about both Mozart. And I think that's a really fascinating aspect of human experience.
I think it is too, and I think it also has. I love this idea of broadening the discussion beyond physics and beyond science, because this has kind of come up a couple times in some recent dialogues I've had, but I think it's completely valid what you're saying about that, the coming at it from a musicology kind of perspective and saying this is a completely valid part of a completely valid way of understanding the human experience. So without apology, without qualification, saying, no, there's something here that explains the human experience in a way that, that nothing else can. I think that's wonderful, and I think it needs to be put forth. And it kind of reminds me of this dialogue I've had recently, and I haven't published it, so you haven't had a chance to hear it, but it's with a gentleman who's been on the show before, a professor of religion, but also a novelist and an author from the University of Rice University in Houston, Jeff Kripal.
And yes, I know some of his work, actually.
Fascinating. And here's a guy who's kind of looked at science fiction, has also kind of dabbled in it himself, but says, hey, what about the narrative? So he's coming at it from a kind of a liberal arts standpoint, sure, but also from more saying, you know what? What about the narrative? And what's interesting, because when you were saying that, Peter, I then remembered, you know, and I'm sure you've heard these same anecdotes of authors who say, yes, I start the book and I am in control. And then after a while, the characters I create write the book for me. Yep. You know, I wake up and they tell me what they say. And so, and we can deconstruct that only to a point. We can say, well, you know, that just is, you know, your mind or whatever. But experientially, no, they're going to tell you it's something different. And then, as you're pointing out, we have little bits and pieces of evidence that suggest it really is different in a measurable way, these other kinds of experiences.
Sure, and I think that the discussion about consciousness is very closely linked to these questions. In terms of the compositional experience, what you're saying is something I can relate to very strongly, because of the experience of writing a piece of music. And I think that people who write, for example, poetry is a very close analog, I think, that there is an interaction between you as, in a sense, the creator of the music, because there is a rational component. You know, if you're going to write a long, multi-movement symphony, for example, you do have to have a game plan. And so there is an element of structure in which you mobilize all your kind of rationality. But once you get down to the detail, if you don't actually have the ability also to respond to the music as it kind of evolves, then you probably won't generate something very compelling, because it will just be you. It will just be you. There won't be the sense that the work itself has a kind of inner life to it. I don't know if I'm making sense of what I'm saying, because it's difficult to convey in words. But that I think it was Aaron Copland, although I could be wrong about this, who said that the notes know each other much better than the composer knows them. And that ties in with what you're saying about the novel.
Right.
That there is a kind of independent music, in a way, that you uncover, that you discover as much as you don't so much invent it as you uncover it. And so I think that this question of whether the brain produces or in some respects receives consciousness is obviously at the heart of the contemporary discussion about neuroscience. And
yes, but Peter, here's the rub. I mean, so you and I are on this little island and we're having this wonderful discussion, an interesting discussion, much more interesting than most of the scientific discussions we hear going on, because we're willing to go places that science isn't willing to go. But on this island, I'm wondering, does it really connect? I'm saying I don't think it connects with science, because science is mired in this, oh, it's about the brain. They're going to go back and they're going to keep looking at the brain, and we're going to keep going, hey, guys, it's not over there. It's over here. But it equally is disconnected with this religion. I mean, with Christianity. Is it really connected? Can we really... We're mixing metaphors here, but is there really a bridge to be made? Can we really paper over those differences, or are they just too great?
Well, I think that ultimately there is, if you're committed to the unity of, I don't use a kind of big phrase there, but the unity of truth, I think that ultimately there has to be a bridge, but it might take a very, very long time for us to get over it. And also, I think our language does create so many obstacles. But going, this is what I've seen in interdisciplinary work, is that there's a big disconnect between left-brained and right-brained people. I mean, that's a crude sort of separation, but it is my experience that particularly in terms of people who think really in logical and analytic categories, and people who are rather more intuitive, that those two groups have a hard time understanding each other, and that sometimes the dialogue is going to be fraught and going to be difficult. I'd like to go back to another phrase of Olivier Messiaen, who was obviously interested in so many different things, and he said that he saw them as one reality seen from different angles. And that's the way I approach the different disciplines, is that obviously each discipline has its own methodology. It has its own set of concerns. And that sometimes these concerns mesh in a really rather difficult way, if they mesh at all. But I'm really committed to seeking these bridges, because I think that if you're really serious about the search for truth, then you shouldn't be put off by the fact that there is apparent tension between the disciplines. Obviously, the question of materialist science is one where I think where a lot of historical work has to be done, that so many people are under the impression that science is, by its very nature, a materialist affair. And I think that that's a very limited view.
It may be limited, but we have to look at how accurate it is, particularly when we look at how it is currently practiced, understood, institutionalized in our society. And I would say the same goes with religion in a different way. I think modern Christianity is completely wed to materialism in some fundamental ways that make it hard to pull it out of there. And that's so this is the rub I have with the wonderful dialogue I have with some of my Christian friends. And, you know, just recently I had a guest on, Michael Heiser, biblical scholar, really nice guy. Enjoyed the conversation, intelligent guy, bright guy. But I got to the point that I feel like I get to so often with Christians, and it gets down to doctrine. And I keep pushing, saying, well, wait a minute, you know, we're having this great conversation, but I feel like we're always going to get to that point where you're going to say, well, I am a Christian, you know, so we're going to push it so far. And then the person's going to say, you know, you're going to say, well, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't make sense. You can't really have this doctrine. You can't really have this belief set as rigidly as it's said here, as it's practiced. And then the fallback is, well, come on, I am a Christian. And I think that there's a direct parallel with the scientist. I think the scientist at the end of the day, whether they say it explicitly or not, and they don't say it explicitly, but what they're really saying is, you know, I am a materialist because at the end of the day, if I can't measure it, I'm out of business. I don't really know what I do if you tell me I can't really measure everything, that this reality isn't the limit of what I can go out and run my experiments on. And so I think fundamentally, we got to be just really blunt and honest about the real chance for us to connect without letting go of a heck of a lot, and maybe even letting go of this idea of, well, I am a Christian. And maybe it's kind of this post-Christian, you know, progressive Christian kind of understanding that I don't know that most people can get there.
Sure. I think you made some very perceptive points there, particularly the one about a sort of marriage of convenience or Faustian pact in a way between Christianity and, I would say, rationalism. But what's curious, if you actually do the history, is that that's a relatively recent phenomenon. And it is tied, I think that there is a very close tie to the rise of a certain type of science and a religious rationalism, which insists that doctrine really is about questions of proof and questions of discursive knowledge, propositions, and a dogma in the worst sense. Now, there are a lot of historians who say that really is a very short-sighted view of what the broader Judeo-Christian tradition really is about, which is much more mysterious and a little bit more fluid than that. But the people don't actually know this tradition very well. because nobody's really ever told it to them. So that as soon as you start talking about the fact that certainly in the early centuries, the church seems to be much more open to mystical experience, to be much happier not trying to codify everything in terms of doctrine, or if they had to say, well, this is kind of the least inadequate way of speaking about something that ultimately we don't understand, mm-hmm. But that the truth that we're about is much more relational than it is propositional. And I think that there actually are a lot of people in Christianity, but perhaps not only in Christianity, perhaps in other sort of wisdom traditions and faiths, who are saying that, hang on, one of the big problems in the world today is that we've got hooked up with this notion of dogma. And it's dogma in the sense of an effort to control. I think control is really the key thing. Because as soon as you have a doctrine which you say is corresponds to reality in a sort of one-to-one way, mm-hmm. that gives you a method of nature. You know, Descartes said we've become the masters and possessors of nature by his method. And that is common both to a certain type of science mm-hmm. and a certain type of religion. Mm-hmm. And we can see what problems that has created from both those streams, mm-hmm. both in terms of the sort of ecological devastation that the idea of the dominance of nature mm-hmm. has created through a certain form of applied science in technology, and also through a kind of religious tribalism that's come about by saying, look, we have the doctrine here. We are the ones who got the truth in a sort of really, really crude way, which gives us, of course, license to eliminate anybody who we feel is in the opposing camp. Now, it's clear to a lot of people that we've really got to get beyond this, because if we don't, the consequences are going to be dire.
I think that's wonderful, and I agree with a lot of that. But I have to push a little bit further on a couple points. One,
go ahead.
I love the esoteric Christian mysticism that you refer to. I think it's deep. It has many little morsels of wisdom that are probably really relevant. But I do want to push and say, is that really represented in mainstream Christianity as we see? I don't see it. And I'd go one step further and I'd say, you know, even the dialogue that you're promoting here, if we really deconstruct it, I love where you're going with it. I just would like to know how much of that richness that you're bringing and openness really makes it in. Because I look at somebody like Keith Ward, and I love some of the things that he says, and I can get into the cheerleading mode of go beat up Richard Dawkins thing. But then I can sit back and go, oh my God, is this really the guy that we want to put out there? And I'll say that by sharing this quote. You know, here's a quote from Keith Ward about the Bible, right? There may be discrepancies and errors in the sacred writing, but those truths that God wished to see included in the scripture and which are important to our salvation are placed there without error. This is the problem. If this is the best we have in terms of a thinker, a philosopher, a modern thinker on Christianity, we're lost. And we're going to be in this debate, this little sideshow circus that Richard Dawkins and Keith Ward can create forever, because it's just goofy. It doesn't make any real sense. Because from a scientific standpoint, how would we ever test such a claim? And what would we do with evidence that contradicts it?
Well, I think that, I mean, Keith, knowing him a little now, I think is actually quite a little bit more of a flexible thinker than that one isolated quote would perhaps portray. Actually, incidentally, Keith has got a lot of problems with religious fundamentalists for some of the things that he's said. So he's far from being one of the more kind of dogmatic apologists.
I know he is, but see, here's the rub for me, I guess, that I was trying to get to, and then I'm going to leave this point because I don't want it to kind of dominate the whole thing, but it's like, this is, now we're getting down to the real brass tacks of Christianity. This is Keith saying, at the end of the day, I am a Christian, you know, so I have to hold on to some doctrine here, because I might not be a Christian. If I give up virgin birth, resurrection, whatever, take your pick, then I no longer have as Mike Heiser said, then, well, I wonder if we really have a religion anymore. And I guess I say, you know, if we're really going to get past this, and if we're really going to ask the scientist to give up their materialistic, reductionistic thinking, then don't we have to give up something on the other end? And I think what we have to give up is any, you know, firm understanding, like you're saying, that we really understand the nature of this higher consciousness. If to pretend that we really understand the mind of God, and we really understand that, yes, he did put these words in this book, and that is the truth. I mean, don't we have to let go of that?
Well, I think that Saint Augustine said something which actually relates very strongly to what you're saying. He said, look, if you've understood it, it ain't God. Mm-hmm. And I think that's absolutely mm-hmm. right, is in the sense that as soon as we say that we have the final take on ultimate reality, in a sense that's already self-defeating, because that's whatever term you want to say, and that for a religious person would say that's blasphemous in a way, because a philosopher would say it's self-contradictory. You cannot, if it's ultimate and you're finite, I mean, how can you possibly have the last word on it? I think that obviously working in a church setting, you have to accommodate a wide variety of people who are going to have very different views, some of whom hold extremely fiercely to their doctrines, others who have basically no doctrine at all, and then some people who would say, hang on, we do have beliefs, but it's a question of how we hold those beliefs. That it's not necessarily having opinions, which is wrong, but it's the way those opinions are wielded against mm-hmm. others. Mm-hmm. So how generous are we prepared to be with our orthodoxy, in a way? All of us do have convictions, and I think it would be a mistake to just say that the way forward is not to have any convictions at all. But are you prepared to hold those convictions with an open hand? And to say, hang on, I'm going to be humble about this. And that ultimately, it's not about the dogma. I think that this is the message that if you do take the near-death experience seriously, okay, I mean, I'm not going to say that it's necessarily good news for a certain type of religion. A religion that's very kind of propositional is going to have a hard time with the wide variety of near-death experiences, which seem to be no respecter of persons. But I think that the overwhelming message that there is an ultimate reality and that reality is unconditional love is something so compelling and a rallying point, I think, for people who might otherwise have very diverse beliefs. And that we shouldn't be naive in saying that those beliefs can necessarily be harmonized. But is that really what it's about? Isn't the call to service of others and to genuine search for truth in a way that is never-ending, isn't that something which actually we can all hopefully unite around? If we can't unite around that, then we're not going to be part of this discussion. But I think that we have to bring whatever beliefs we have to the table and hold them lightly. There may be some things we have to check at the door in order to be able to participate in the dialogue. And it's a mark, I think, of the honesty, the intellectual honesty of the participants, to say, yes, I do come with a belief system, but I'm suspicious of any kind of system. And I am open to you to rattle my cage a bit. You know, I'm not going to say that I have got the truth as something that I possess, but that it is a goal towards which we are all progressing. And I think that that's a question, I think the mindset is actually much more important than the content of the dogma in some respects.
Great, and I certainly see how that can join us in an intelligent and meaningful dialogue with others who have arrived at a certain point. I have to wonder, Peter, does that allow us to dialogue with science, quote-unquote, in that materialism here, reductionism, it's the chasm that until you get over that, we can't, it's your entry ticket in. We can't really have that dialogue. So I wonder what kind of meaningful dialogue can we have with someone with someone who insists, as science does, insists that we have a boundary on reality, and that boundary is materialism.
I mean, this is partly why I'm really committed to interdisciplinary work, because what I see is the dialogue is only going to really progress if you have a team of people from different disciplines. I mean, go to another interview that you did with Rick Strassman about the DMT research, which, again, I found absolutely compelling. And also from a sort of Judeo-Christian point of view, to see that he had been forced back to his own Hebrew scriptures in a phenomenological way by the way that the results of his research were so counterintuitive that he couldn't fit them into his paradigm. And that because he's an honest and sincere searcher for the truth, he had to say, well, we're not just going to ignore the results, we're going to have to change the paradigm. And I think that is the mark of intellectual honesty. But that once he started getting into I love his current research project to look back at the Hebrew scriptures and say, hang on, what is it about the prophetic writings that seems to be so close to near-death experience reports? Why is that? And that's something I think that I've been thinking about in terms of, well, I mean, in terms of this composer, Olivier Messiaen, who in his works on precisely those texts out of the Hebrew Old Testament would produce this incredible, almost psychedelic music. But also the work of somebody like Nancy Evans Bush, former president of the, I think, International Association of Near-Death Studies, who's also looking at this area. And I think that there is potential for doing something really, really groundbreaking, but that it requires people from different disciplines who've actually got the skill sets to take the data and to ask the right questions of those data. But I think that there is a problem, obviously, that there is a disinformation problem. Because most people have very little knowledge of philosophical argumentation. And why should they? Because if it's not taught at school, then unless you're a sort of trained philosopher, you're easily manipulated by people who come with a lot of credentials and can get away with saying outrageous things, and nobody calls them out on it.
You know, in terms of misinformation, disinformation, deception, that's another point that I think I know I've tried to bring into this conversation, and I don't always get a lot of people behind me and with me. But I think if you're honest about it, there's a deliberate deception among a certain wing of the scientific community that sees this new wave of consciousness research as a direct attack on science and scientism, and they mean to counter that attack with disinformation, with deception. There's no other way to explain the antics of, you know, who we always pick on, or Richard Wiseman or Chris French. There's no other way to explain that action. There's really no other way to explain the action of Richard Dawkins.
To defend Richard Dawkins just a little bit, because I feel that charity, I ought to. I think that he has been seriously riled by religious fundamentalists.
Absolutely.
Quite frankly.
Right.
That's why he feels that there is a moral crusade. Sure, I think you brought it back to the central issue, which is control. This phrase, letting go, is, I think, absolutely critical to the whole discussion. From a Christian point of view, that is also critical, because ultimately, I think that Christianity, but not only Christianity, you can find this in other wisdom traditions too, says that you cannot find the way to your true self unless, in a sense, you die to self. And that is about control. Where I see the dividing line is not between the religions. I see the dividing line within the religions themselves. And I treat science sometimes as a form of religion.
Yes. That's the bridge that we have to cross, is that science is a religion, atheism is a religion, and now we're all on the same playing field.
Because it's our ultimate concern. And I'm not a huge fan of Paul Tillich, but that's, I think, a very good definition of religion, is whatever is your ultimate concern is de facto your religion. I think it's a very good definition. And I think if you go back to the idea of who do we want around this table, obviously the entry fee, as you say, is a certain ability to let go, or to say, okay, We all bring ourselves to this, but we bring ourselves to this in an open way. My hope, okay, I mean, you may say I'm naive in this, is that there is a groundswell of people who have this openness and who are genuinely interested in following, in examining the data in an open and intelligent way. And I think there is a big need for the construction of a community like that.
Well, Peter, maybe that's a wonderful way to leave it then. And I certainly join with you in this call for an interdisciplinary approach and the kind that you're certainly trying to take with your lecture series there at the American Church in Paris. So we wish you the best of luck with that. And again, thanks for joining me today on Skeptico.
It's been wonderful to be part of this conversation, Alex.
Thanks again to Peter Bannister for joining me today on Skeptico. So as usual, I have a couple of questions I'd like to tee up from this interview. And the first has to do with this idea of Christianity being wed to materialism in a way that we don't normally think about it, but in a way that has deep, serious implications for the way this whole culture war debate between science and religion takes place. So tell me your thoughts on whether you think modern Christianity is wed to materialism. And the second topic I tee up is this idea that religion is our ultimate concern. I love that definition that Peter gave because I think it gets at the heart of why we argue about these things. And I think it also gets to the heart of how science has become a religion, how atheism is certainly a religion if we think of it in those terms. And those terms are really the way that it's played out in our culture. So that would be another topic I'd be interested to get your feedback on. So to get involved in this dialogue, to jump in, please visit the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. You can join in on the comment section on that page, or you can jump over to our forum where we usually have quite a lively discussion after these shows. Of course, while you're at the Skeptico website, you can check out any of our previous 180 shows for free, or you can directly send me an email or connect with me on Facebook. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Skeptico. I plan to have another episode up next week, so be sure to look for that. And until next time, take care and bye for now.